Chester Gillette was having the time of his life at the Arrowhead Hotel in upstate New York. He was one of the many New Yorkers who flocked to the Adirondack Mountains during the summer to escape from the city and enjoy the outdoors. He and some other hotel guests had just recently hiked up the local mountains, where they camped and ate some beefsteak cooked over the campfire. Chester used his camera to take pictures and joined the other campers in carving his initials and the date into the trees and rocks. He met up with some female friends at a nearby lake and frequently socialized with other hotel guests, just as he did one morning when Chester woke and had breakfast at the hotel. He was in the middle of eating when the sheriffs entered the dining room and arrested him in July of 1906. For the past few days, as Chester was having a blast on vacation, Herkimer County authorities were busy sweeping Big Moose Lake to try and find his body. After they had found an overturned boat and the corpse of a drowned woman, the police were certain that the woman's partner had also drowned. The sheriff identified the woman as Grace Brown from South Othsellick, New York, and she checked into the hotel with a man named Carl Graham, whom the police could not locate. The district attorney ward made some calls to Cortland and South Othsellick, and though no one had ever heard of a man named Carl Graham, the man just so happened to have the same initials as one of Grace's friends, Chester Gillette. So the sheriff dropped the search for Carl Graham and used his resources to locate Chester. Authorities tracked a postcard sent from Gillette to the Arrowhead Hotel, where they found him very much alive and well, as he joked with his friends and sported a sunburn from his most recent hike. When Albert Gross read that his friend Chester was missing, he set out for the lake to assist in the search. But once Gross arrived, he spoke to the DA and the sheriff, who told him that Chester was alive and that they needed Gross to identify his friend. Gross confronted Chester, saying, "Do you know that Billy is drowned?" "No," Chester replied. "Is that so? I thought you were under the water. Don't you know that she is drowned over here in the lake?" Chester responded, "My God, no! Is that so?" Gross asked, "Where were you Wednesday night?" "I came here." "Where were you Tuesday night?" "I was at a camp near Raquette Lake." When Chester became flustered and confused, the sheriff led him back to his room to get his things. The sheriff asked Chester, "What are you talking about? You know this girl is drowned as well as I. What did you do this for?" I'm Elise, and this is the historical true crime podcast, Old Blood. Chester Gillette was born into a wealthy family who relinquished their money and material possessions to devote their lives to serving others. Chester's parents became missionaries for the Salvation Army and traveled across the United States to wherever they were needed, everywhere from Montana to Oregon, San Francisco, and Hawaii. But Chester was not at all interested in his parents' lifestyle and was something of a problem child besides that. He was forever getting into trouble at school. He stole, he lied constantly, he ran away from home as a child, and even as Chester grew from a boy into a man, he still had trouble realizing that actions have consequences. To Chester, the whole point of life was to, in his words, have as good a time as you can. Consequences be damned. With the help of some other wealthy relatives, Chester managed to enroll in prep school at Oberlin College. He did well at first and was a bright student, but Chester became distracted and his grades slipped, culminating in his dropping out. He moved to Cortland, New York, where he began working for his wealthy uncle, Noah H. Gillette, who owned the Gillette Skirt Factory. What Chester did like was girls, and there were plenty of them in Cortland. While at work one day, a girl's opal ring fell off and rolled across the floor, so Chester picked it up and handed it back to her. The girl was attractive and lively, and before long, Chester was stopping at her workstation constantly. He was reprimanded more than once for doing so, but this did not stop him. The girl began sharing her lunches and candies with him, and Chester began visiting her outside of work hours. The girl was Grace Brown, and her beginnings were far different from Chester's. She grew up on her family's farm in the small town of South Otselic in upstate New York. She lived on the farm nearly her entire life, but she was by no means a boring girl. She was quick of wit, had an excellent sense of humor, and loved to have fun, especially by dancing. The great true crime author Harold Schechter claimed that Grace loved dancing so much that her church even banned her from attending because of it. She loved music. She sang and danced to the song, "Bill Bailey, Won't You Please Come Home," so often that her friends and family always called her Billy rather than Grace. When she was about 18 years old, Grace moved to Cortland to help her sister take care of her new baby. The idea of living in a city was an exciting prospect for a girl who had lived on a rural farm her whole life. And city living became even more exhilarating when she took a job at the Gillette Skirt Factory. Grace was not too interested in Chester when she first met him, as he returned her runaway ring. But Chester was persistent and constantly stopped by her desk. Despite her initial ambivalence, Chester was also very attractive, charismatic, and worldly, and she fell in love with him. Chester continued spending most of his time near Grace at work, despite supervisors telling him to get back to work. But Chester carried the Gillette name, and there was not too much the supervisors could do about the matter. Before long, Chester was also visiting Grace at her sister's home at least two nights a week. Grace's sister did not insist on her having a chaperone during his visits, and the two often cuddled together on the couch after her sister and brother-in-law went to bed. But then tragedy struck when her sister's two-year-old child died. Her sister could no longer bear to live in Cortland, and so she and her husband moved away for a fresh start. Grace's parents expected her to return home to the Otselic farm, but then her father received two letters from people at the Skirt Factory, including one from the owner, Mr. Gillette himself, asking that he allow Grace to return to work in Cortland. This was all organized by Chester, as was Mrs. Wheeler, who agreed to take Grace into her boarding house. Since the Wheeler home was considered a respectable place for a young girl who lived far away from her family, Grace's father allowed her to return to work and, unwittingly, to Chester. Despite her fun-loving nature, Grace loved her family and did not wish to do anything to upset them, so she rebuffed Chester's advances every time he wanted their relationship to become more physical. By the summer of 1905, Grace finally relented and began having sex with Chester. Chester's family name allowed him into Cortland's high society, and he used these connections to become popular with the daughters of the city's prominent citizens. And while Chester still visited Grace for sex, he courted the more so-called respectable ladies in public and made friends with Cortland's wealthy young men. Terrified of losing the man she loved, Grace tried to make peace with her situation and convinced herself that since she couldn't be out and about at parties and social events, she assented to Chester having fun without her. Grace's friends and family began noticing that while Chester continued to visit Grace in private, he refused to be seen with her in public. Grace's younger sister visited her in Cortland once and, after meeting Chester, told her sister, "I don't like him. He doesn't look at you straight. He has a shifty eye." When Chester's family began asking him why and scolding him for seeing a woman in private whom he would not be with in public, Chester responded that he was just having his fun and that they should mind their own business. Chester's cousin, Harold Gillette, son of the factory owner, confronted him once asking if he was seeing Grace, but Chester denied it. And though the cousins were not close and did not hang out together, Harold did often see Chester at the same events, always with other girls, but never with Grace. Meanwhile, Grace's friends began telling her about all the occasions in which they had seen Chester with other women. While at work one day, someone called Grace over to the window and pointed out Chester talking to a woman who had come to visit him in the factory. The two talked for about 15 minutes, and Grace was finally forced to confront the reality of their relationship. A few minutes after Chester went back to work, Grace excused herself to go confront him. She returned to her desk several minutes later, where she buried her head in her skirt and began to sob. She spent the rest of the workday in tears. It was the culmination of all of her fears that, from the moment she consented to sleep with Chester, he had lost all interest in her. Towards the end of 1906, the situation grew dire when Grace realized that she was pregnant, and her unhappiness turned to desperation. We will likely never know what Chester's immediate reaction to Grace's news was like, but we can assume that Chester was not at all enthusiastic about becoming a father, and even less enthusiastic about becoming a husband. As for Grace, there was not much else she could do but beg Chester to do the right thing and marry her before her situation became too obvious. As soon as it became clear that she was pregnant and unmarried, she would essentially be ostracized from her community and would likely never find a decent man willing to marry her. Grace would be considered a ruined woman. Chester evidently thought that he needed to give Grace something, if not just to get her off of his case. On the night of a women's only sorority party, when he had nothing better to do and knew all the women he was seeing would be busy, Chester relented. He brought Grace out to Little York Lake. Except this was where he had previously been with another woman, and it upset Grace, who at the time said that she should have been taken there instead. Chester rented a boat for them from the owner of a hotel on the lake, and after spending about an hour in it, the couple returned after night fell. When the hotel owner retrieved his boat, he noticed Grace standing further back in the dark, and when he turned on the light to help her see her way onto the buggy they were taking to leave, he saw that she had been crying. Grace became ill, both with worry and from what was a difficult pregnancy, so she returned to the Brown Farm in South Otselic. Her family, who did not know that she was pregnant, was shocked to find the happy-go-lucky Billy, who was always singing and dancing and having fun, suddenly turned into a sickly-looking girl. She was constantly weak and crying and was so stressed out that she lost a lot of weight, rather than gaining it as she should have been while pregnant. The fact that Grace had always been a rather small girl at 100 pounds and only 5'2" made her weight loss even more shocking to them. Her father, Frank Brown, once said that he and his wife always relied heavily on Grace, who was eager to help her parents with chores and around the farm. But now Grace had lost all interest in doing the things she used to love to do, and spent her days either writing to Chester and begging him to visit, or sitting in front of the window and staring out at the road, hoping to see him. She developed terrible headaches, which her mother tried to soothe with what we would now call aromatherapy. She was always tired and weak with morning sickness. And Chester continued with his social life, apparently believing that if he just continued to ignore the problem, it would resolve on its own. Nowhere in the letters between Grace and Chester are there any hints that Chester proposed to her, or even promised to marry her, despite Grace's plea for him to do right by her. But they did discuss taking a trip together. It's possible that Chester merely wanted to take Grace away for her to have the child in secret, and then give away. But Grace obviously hoped it was an elopement. Grace sensed Chester's hesitation and sent him a flurry of concerned letters in which she expressed her doubts that Chester would stay true to his word to go away with her. Just after returning to her family's farm, she wrote, "If you were only here, I would not feel so badly. I knew I should worry all the time. I do try to be brave, dear, but how can I when everything goes wrong? I can't help thinking you will never come for me. But then I say you can't be so mean as that. Everything worries me, and I am so frightened, dear. It won't make any difference to you about you coming a few days earlier than you intended, will it, dear? It means so much to me. Please write often, and in every one of your letters, I wish you would tell me not to worry about your coming for me. And then the next day, my dear Chester, I am writing to tell you I am coming back to Cortland. I simply can't stay here any longer. Mama worries and wonders why I cry so much, and I am just about sick. Please come and take me away from someplace, dear. You have said you would come, and sometimes I just know you will. But then I think about other things, and I am just as certain you won't come. Chester, there isn't a girl in the whole world as miserable as I am tonight. And you have made me feel so, Chester. I don't mean that, dear. You have always been awfully good to me. You just won't be a coward, I know. I am about crazy with grief, and that I don't know just what to do. Please write to me, dear. And the following day. I never came down this morning until nearly 8 o'clock, and I fainted about 10 o'clock and stayed in bed until nearly noon. This p.m., my brother brought me a letter from one of the girls, and after I read the letter, I fainted again. Chester, I came home because I thought I could trust you. This girl wrote me that you seemed to be having an awfully good time, and she guessed that my coming home had done you good, as you had not seemed so cheerful in weeks. She also said that you spent most of your time with that detestable Grace Hill. I should have known, Chester, that you did not care for me, but somehow I have trusted you more than anyone else. If I could only die. I know how you feel about this affair, and I wish for your sake you need not be troubled. If I die, I hope you can then be happy. I hope I can die. The doctor says I will, and then you can do just as you like. Lovingly, the kid. As in Billy the Kid. P.S. Write often, please. Eventually, Grace's nerves forced her onto a wagon into downtown Ostzelik, where the Gothic House Hotel had a telephone that she asked to use. She called the Gillette Skirt Factory, sending everyone into a frenzy, when they heard that there was a phone call for Chester from Ostzelik. Everyone in the factory knew it was Grace. Chester stayed on the line for only several minutes and gave terse responses, while Grace cried on the other end and worried the hotel staff. Grace finally received a reply from Chester after the first three letters went unanswered. The letter was abrupt and unemotional, even with Chester's reply that he was sorry for her worrying, that there was no reason to. Grace responded in a letter, longer than all the others, and expressed her disappointment in his business-like tone. She wrote, "You consider me as something troublesome that you are bothered with. You think if it wasn't for me, you could do as you liked all summer and not be obliged to give up your position there. I don't suppose how you have ever considered how it puts me out of all the good times for the summer, and how I had to give up my position there. I think all this is about as bad for me as for you, don't you? I don't suppose you will ever know how I regret being all this trouble to you. I know you hate me, and I can't blame you one bit. My whole life is ruined, and in a measure yours is too. Of course, it is worse for me than you, but the world and you too may think I am the only one to blame. But somehow I can't, just simply can't think I am, Chester. I said no so many times, dear. Of course, the world will not know that, but it's true all the same." The next morning, Grace woke up anxious that her letter had been too harsh, and was afraid that it would push Chester even further away. But when she went to destroy the letter, she found that her parents had already sent it. So she wrote another one, apologizing for sending what she called a hateful letter, and begged his forgiveness. Chester finally wrote his second letter in the 2 weeks since Grace had been in Ostzelik, saying, in part, "Perhaps I wrote too harshly Friday about your telephoning, and you worry, but it was entirely unnecessary and not at all satisfactory, because I couldn't say what I wanted to. Don't do such a foolish thing again. Above all things, don't worry and cry so, or you will be down sick. In the meantime, have as good a time as you can so as to have something to think about." The letters continued until Chester wrote that he would have to push back the day he would meet her to several days later. Grace wrote that she had planned for Saturday and that was when she would meet him. And if he was not there, she would go to Cortland and get him. And while Chester may not have cared much about everything else Grace said, he certainly cared about her threat to return to Cortland and ruin his reputation by exposing their relationship. As Grace's friends warned her, Chester spent the 4th of July celebration on a date at Little York Lake with Harriet Benedict, daughter of a prominent Cortland lawyer. The occasion was captured for posterity with Chester's new lightweight Kodak camera when Chester and Harriet took pictures of each other out on the lake. The next night, when everyone else was in bed, Grace curled up by the kitchen fire to pen her last letter to Chester. "This is the last letter I can write, dear. I feel as though you are not coming. Perhaps this is not right, but I cannot help feeling that I am never going to see you again. I am going down next Sunday night, dear, and then go to De Ruyter the next morning and will get there about 10 o'clock. If you take the 9:45 train, you will get there about 11. I have been bidding goodbye to some places today. There are so many nooks, dear, and all of them so dear to me. I have lived here nearly all of my life. First, I said goodbye to the spring house with its great masses of green moss, then a beehive, a cute little house in the orchard, and, of course, all of the neighbors that have mended my dresses from a little tot up to save me a thrashing I really deserved. Oh, dear, you don't realize what all this is to me. I know I shall never see any of them again. And Mama, great heavens, how I do love Mama. I don't know what I shall do without her. She is never cross, and she always helps me so much. I will never be happy again, dear. I wish I could die. I'm going to bed now, dear. Please come, and don't let me wait there. Heaven bless you until then, lovingly and with kisses, the kid." According to Craig Brandon, who wrote a book about this case titled Murder in the Adirondacks, Chester had several options regarding what to do with Grace that likely ran through his mind in the few days before leaving Cortland. First, he could do what he likely led Grace to believe he would do, which was marry her and save her from the shame of being an unwed mother. He could also have simply run away to escape responsibility for the child, but both of these two options meant sacrificing the financial and social position he had cultivated in Cortland, which, obviously, was not appealing to him. Refusing to marry her would have the same consequences, particularly since there were so many witnesses to Chester and Grace's romance at the factory, and he could hardly claim the child was not his. And even if he could, the scandal of it all would still ruin him. It's unclear whether or not Grace considered giving up the child after it was born, though they likely didn't consider abortion since it was so difficult to obtain then, with doctors unwilling to risk their livelihoods to perform one. Going away until the child was born would certainly have raised some questions, and we don't even know if Grace offered that as an option. Clearly, Grace loved Chester and wanted nothing more than to marry him. The final option, Brandon explained, was to simply get rid of Grace, an idea that Brandon thought might have been put into Chester's head by Grace herself when she spoke about wanting to die. On a July Sunday, Chester returned to his boarding room and packed up some of his things, including some tennis balls and a tennis racket. He left behind his more expensive possessions, like his desk and bicycle, and told the landlady that he would continue to pay for his room while he was gone and would likely be back in a week or two. Chester and his suitcase, monogrammed with the initials CEG, left Cortland for the small town of De Ruyter. Grace spent her last night in South Otselic with her best friend and former teacher, Maud Crum. Grace packed almost all of her belongings, including all of her clothes, some new ones she made for the trip that was later rumored to have been meant as wedding clothes, and her old factory clothes, just in case she obtained a job wherever she and Chester ended up. We can infer from the contents of her suitcase and her letter that describes saying goodbye to her home that Grace did not intend to return to Otselic. She told her father that she was going back to work in Cortland, and then went to meet Chester at De Ruyter to embark on their trip. The Adirondacks consist of 6 million acres, or 5,000 square miles of mountainous forests and over 200 lakes, including the source of the Hudson River, which runs south through the state of New York, all the way down to New York City, where it meets the Atlantic Ocean. The Adirondacks are ancient. There is evidence that people lived there as far back as 15 to 7,000 BC, and Native Americans tended to the land long before Europeans began colonizing what is now New York. The word Adirondacks evolved from a Mohawk Indian word, meaning tree eaters, and was used as far back as the 1700s, though the Adirondacks were not officially named until 1837. By the late 1800s, Americans viewed the Adirondacks as a so-called healing destination for those who suffered from illnesses like tuberculosis. Victorians' obsession with the great outdoors and recreation, the Adirondacks experienced a boom in which camps and resorts sprang up throughout the park. Thus, when Chester and Grace departed for the Adirondack Mountains, they had plenty of options to choose from. Once the couple was in De Ruyter, they sat and discussed travel plans, deciding to first go to Fourth Lake, which was one of a few called the Fulton Chain of Lakes. But since there were people in De Ruyter who knew them, the two took different rail cars to get there. On Chester's, he was surprised to find several female friends from Cortland. After some talk, Chester told them he might be able to meet them at Seventh Lake later on in the week, likely Thursday or Friday. Upon hearing the girls would be at Seventh Lake, Grace decided to instead head for Tupper Lake to avoid seeing them. Grace and Chester finally sat together on the train as they headed for Utica and stayed the night at a hotel as Charles Gordon and wife. Since Chester wanted his alias to match his monogram suitcase, and because he didn't want anyone to find out that an unmarried Grace was sleeping alone with a man. It was also convenient for him when the two took off without paying their hotel and dining bill. According to Brandon, after a 3.5-hour train ride, the two arrived at Tupper Lake. They stayed the night in another hotel but didn't like the area, so they planned to leave the next day. When they woke that morning and went to breakfast, Grace allegedly cried through her meal. They boarded a train and set off for Big Moose Lake, just north of Fourth Lake where Chester's friends were. Both sent postcards to their families. Grace wrote to her mom, letting her know that she was okay and happy, and asking her to keep her sisters in school, which was evidence that Grace planned to be gone for a while. And Chester asked his relative at the skirt factory to send him $5 to Eagle Bay, where he planned to be on Friday. Chester and Grace finally arrived at the Glenmore Hotel, a rustic lodge that sat right on Big Moose Lake. Chester checked them in as Carl Graham from Albany and Grace Brown from South Otselic. Chester approached the clerk, Andrew Morrison, and asked about seeing the lake by steamboat, which Morrison didn't have the details about and knew they would not be back in time for dinner as they wanted, so he suggested taking out a rowboat instead. Brandon claimed that since Grace couldn't swim and Chester knew that, Grace would probably have been more comfortable in the steamboat. But Chester was an expert boater and supposedly wanted to be back in time for dinner, so the two took a rowboat out on Big Moose Lake. Chester inexplicably left Grace's straw hat in the hotel, which was odd, because Victorian women had an aversion to forming freckles from the sun, a fact that became even odder when he decided to load his suitcase into the boat with him, which the boatkeeper said he had never seen done before. Strapped to the suitcase were Chester's tennis racket and umbrella. He put Grace on the most comfortable seat in the back of the boat, and situated himself in the front where the oars were. The couple floated around all day to different parts of the lake, enjoying the nice weather and collecting pond lilies, before being seen at around 5:45 p.m., drifting off into a remote bay surrounded by swampy land unsuitable for any sort of campers. That night, when Robert Morrison, the boatkeeper and father of the hotel clerk, realized that the couple had not returned with the rental boat, he didn't think much of it. It certainly was not the first time tourists misjudged the lake size and ended up staying at another, closer hotel for the night, and it wouldn't be the last either. But he did become concerned the next day when the two still had not returned. Morrison arranged for a steamer to go out on Big Moose Lake to search for the couple, where they finally discovered the rowboat, overturned and floating around the lake with a woman's cape draped over top of it. A man's straw hat floated nearby close to the shore. When the search party looked down into the shallow water, they noticed a white shape tangled in weeds. Using a pole, they managed to pull the object above water. Grace Brown's face came into view first, followed by her chest and the rest of her body. Once the search party had hauled Grace's body onto the steamboat, they began discussing her head wounds. Clotted blood fell from her nostrils. Her lips were swollen, discolored, and bloody. Part of her hair had fallen around her shoulders, and one stocking had slid down her leg where it got caught over her shoe. It also appeared as though she had suffered wounds to her nose and eye. They continued their search, even dragging the lake, trying to find Grace's companion. They knew from the hotel register that the dead woman was Grace Brown, but the authorities had no idea who this Carl Graham guy was. The straw hat they found gave them few answers, as the label had been torn out. When Sheriff Clock and D.A. Ward figured out that their suspect was Chester Gillette and arrested him, Chester began telling conflicting accounts of what had happened. Clock said that Chester first told him that he stood up in the boat to fix his hat, and the boat overturned. But then later, he said that the boat upset when he was trying to reach a pond lily for Grace. Then, he said he was making his way to the back of the boat where Grace was, when the boat flipped. He tried telling Grace to hold on to the boat so she wouldn't drown, but he hadn't been able to reach her. At trial, and with the help of his lawyer, Chester gave his official story of what had happened. He said that he and Grace were discussing what to do about their situation, and he suggested going back to Otselic to tell her parents and get their help. Grace supposedly refused, and after some back and forth about it, Grace became hysterical and said, "I will end it here," before jumping out of the boat. Chester explained, she jumped into the lake, stepped up onto the boat, kind of threw herself in. I tried to reach her. I leaned back in the sea on the other end, the bow seat, I guess. I tried to reach her then, and, well, I was not quick enough. I went into the lake, too. The boat tipped over as I started up, or when I started to get up, the boat went right over then. Of course, I went into the lake. Then I came up, I hallooed, grabbed hold of the boat, and then as soon as I could see to get the water out of my eyes and see, I got hold of the boat, or got to the boat. I did not see her. Then I swam to the shore. Chester said that he went to his suitcase, which had conveniently been left on the shore earlier in the day, and put on some dry clothes. He then took off through the woods towards the Arrowhead Hotel with his suitcase and tennis racket. He said the racket was getting in his way, so he stopped and left it underneath a log and covered it with dirt. From the wounds to Grace's head, the DA and sheriff were sure that Grace was violently beaten and argued that Chester had used his tennis racket to do so. They believe Chester took his racket with him into the boat because he already made plans to murder Grace with it, and he took all of his belongings into the boat with him because he knew he would have to run away right after. Once the case went to trial, the prosecution argued that it made no sense for Chester to throw out the lightweight and relatively expensive racket he was carrying for far heavier but cheaper things he could have tossed, like his camera tripod. They also couldn't understand why, if Chester fell in the water when the boat overturned, neither his clothing nor his suitcase and all of its contents were wet. Chester later came out with a story that earlier in the day, he and Grace had gone to shore for a bit and left the suitcase there to come back for. Still, the DA was not convinced and asked Chester during the trial, "How did you save the dress suitcase and lose the girl?" Nearly every move Chester made since deciding to take Grace away was proof to the authorities that Chester had long planned to do away with his pregnant lover. His decision to tell several people that he would only be gone for a little while, his leaving belongings in Cortland and continuing to rent the room, his aliases to check into places. Prosecutors believe that Chester purposely used Grace's real name because he wanted her identified immediately rather than having to uncover a bunch of information about her that might lead back to Chester as a suspect. And then Chester's telling his female friends on the train that they would likely see him by the end of the week, without any mention of Grace being there with him, was also just a tad suspicious. The murder of Grace Brown makes an extraordinary story for many reasons. The most obvious of these is the scene of the crime, out in the Adirondacks, one of the most beautiful places in the world, and the last place one would think for a tragedy to occur. And then there is the story of Grace and Chester itself, which so many can relate to. Few of us have not had our hearts broken. Few of us have not been betrayed by someone we trust. And many women have probably had an experience similar to Grace's, trusting the man they love only for him to wrong her, only for her to find that he was not the man she thought he was at all. And then there were Grace's letters. It is so rare to find insights into the minds of murdered women, because they are so often silenced with death. This is particularly true with historical cases, because women's thoughts and experiences have rarely been preserved for posterity, if they were copied down at all to begin with, seeing as, historically, women were less likely to have been literate. Yet from reading Grace's letters, we almost feel as though we knew her personally. At times, her writing seems more fit for a diary than a letter, because she expressed herself so honestly, so poignantly. I find it hard to believe that anyone who has read Grace's letters could doubt the love she felt for Chester, nor the overwhelming desperation and heartbreak she suffered from his careless ways. If there were any one piece of evidence that sealed Chester's fate, it was, ironically, Grace's love letters to him. Nothing could have swayed the jurors to Grace's side more than her own words. The defense tried to stop the prosecution from reading Grace's letters at trial, precisely because they knew how inflammatory they would be to Chester's defense. The judge ultimately allowed the prosecution to read from these letters, but only on the condition that they not try to use the letters as proof of anything that happened, and use them only to show Grace's frame of mind and how she viewed Chester. The DA worried that the jury might side against Grace since society would have labeled her as a quote-unquote fallen woman for giving in to Chester and getting pregnant, but her letters seemed to override this as the jury witnessed how pure and innocent her love was for Chester. At one point, the prosecution tried to make the argument that Chester had raped her, saying, quote, "the deceased was just there for him to force and rape," end quote, to avoid any of the jury condemning Grace for sleeping with him, but the judge disallowed it since there was no proof that they had any non-consensual sex. But this turned out to be a moot point anyway, because Grace's letters moved everyone so deeply that it was difficult for anyone to care about her so-called mistakes. Still, the prosecution tried to make Chester out to be the bad guy anyway, often referring to him as a wolf with raving fangs, and quoting the parts of Grace's letters that made it seem as though she had resisted him as much as she possibly could. One of her letters said, "I know that you don't care for me anymore like you did, and that you are wishing things could be different. And yet, what am I to do? How often did I beg you not to make me do what I did not want to do, and which I was afraid even then I would regret, although I loved you too much to let you go. You still insisted on having your way. Oh, please, please, I beg of you not to torture me with any more delays now." When the prosecution read Grace's letters to the court, many began sobbing, particularly when the DA reached her final letter, in which Grace bid goodbye to her home and family. Also not helping the matter was the fact that Chester sat emotionless throughout the trial, as though he had felt nothing for Grace at all. When the rest of the court wept at Grace's loss, Chester sat there, cool as a cucumber. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he was guilty, But his behavior did convince at least a few of the jurors that he was a heartless man who cared nothing for Grace and would not have batted an eye at killing her to get his way. And Brandon also pointed out that the jury was composed of men, farmers, just like Frank Brown, Grace's father. Many of the jurors likely felt as though it could just as easily have happened to them and their daughters, and they felt no sympathy for a stone-hearted city slicker like Chester, who took advantage of their naive and simple country daughters. Susan Harriman, professor of law, wrote about the impact Grace's letters had on the trial's outcome. Quote, "In law, as in literature, narrative plays a central role. Every trial offers the jury competing stories from which to choose. The jury's choice was between Chester's version of the events in question and that of Grace Brown, a sympathetic figure whose story was told in letters written in her own voice and read by the prosecution to dramatic effect. What did the jury get to know about Chester Gillette? That he lied, persistently." End quote. Herman, as well as others, point out that the prosecution's case was simply circumstantial. Without hard evidence to prove Chester's guilt, it should have been difficult to convict him of murder, but because of Grace's narrative and sympathetic character, it wasn't. Don't get me wrong, the prosecution went all out trying to find witnesses and evidence. In fact, the DA gathered a total of almost 100 witnesses, but none of these were first-hand witnesses of the murder itself. The closest DA Ward got to that was one woman who had been one of the last to see Grace alive, who saw Chester and Grace rowing into the secluded area where she was murdered, and heard a scream. At first, the woman said it was either a woman's scream or a small boy's, but then she immediately corrected herself and said, no, it definitely was the shriek of a woman. The defense tried to make some argument about how the woman was not an expert on sounds or voices or something dumb like that, but this convinced no one. As for evidence, the prosecution had the boat, which had locks of Grace's hair caught in the seat hardware that the defense said could just as easily have been done by her accidentally or purposely falling into the water. Chester's suitcase and other belongings, which the prosecution argued was proof that Chester intended to return to Cortland without Grace, but that the defense rightfully said was still circumstantial evidence since they couldn't prove that's what Chester was thinking. The DA managed to get Chester to lead them to the tennis racket he hid, which they claimed was the murder weapon. They found the racket dirty and wet, looking as though someone had bashed the racket itself in. But the defense managed to find a tennis expert who testified to the fact that when the racket's strings get wet, they tend to snap. And, as the defense argued, Grace could very well have gotten the lacerations to her head from accidentally falling and hitting her head on the boat, or something in the water. Granted, the lake, at least in all the places near the incident, was full of silt and soft materials and not rocks, but it still was true that there were many ways Grace could have gotten her wounds rather than from being beaten by a tennis racket. Like, say, an oar. And of course, there was Grace's body itself as evidence. During the trial, the prosecution brought forward the doctors who worked with Grace's corpse and asked them to detail their findings. The Herkimer County undertaker noted that Grace's nose looked flattened, and that in addition to her discolored lips and left cheek, she had a tooth loose in its socket, and said, "This injury to the lip and teeth and nose had been inflicted before death." Other physicians noted an incision on the scalp, and that, quote, "the injury had penetrated the skull into the brain matter beneath the skull, which ruptured the brain's blood vessels and created a blood clot." End quote. One physician argued that the blow to Grace's head would have paralyzed or interfered with the respiratory functions, would have rendered the action of the heart extremely weak and feeble, and that an injury of that nature is dangerous to life. They were sufficient in themselves to cause death in a living subject. The medical examiners also stated that the blow to Grace's eye would have made her blind, that the injury to her nose depressed the cartilage, and that Grace was, in fact, about 3 to 4 months pregnant. They concluded, quote, "The physicians testify that these injuries occurred before death and was necessarily such as to produce unconsciousness from shock," end quote. Ultimately, the physicians argued that Grace died from shock and concussion, which were the results of a blow to the head before being immersed in water. Grace had not died by drowning. This all sounds legit and pretty condemning for Chester's case, but come to find out, Grace's autopsy was botched when Grace's body was accidentally embalmed before the autopsy was performed. One doctor who spent 5 years as the coroner admitted, as Brandon says, that, quote, "he was not an authority on postmortems," end quote. He hadn't consulted anyone else while performing the autopsy, and he hadn't even conducted an autopsy since he was in medical school. Apparently, D.A. Ward gave this doctor notes to use while on the witness stand, rather than the notes he had taken himself while performing the autopsy. And of course, D.A. Ward's case was based upon the argument that Chester killed Grace by beating her over the head with his tennis racket before she fell into the water. So that was what the doctor told everyone. Noted that there was no evidence of drowning. Like, he did not find air inside her lungs the way he would have had the victim drowned. But when the defense took their turn to question the coroner, his so-called expert testimony fell to pieces when the coroner finally admitted that actually there were signs of drowning. It just wasn't in the autopsy report because of how all the doctors met several different times to make sure that all of their stories matched. Many parts of this trial would never occur today that were allowed back then, or at least ignored, the snafu with the autopsy included. One other major episode during the murder trial occurred when the prosecution brought in a large bottle containing the fetus that was removed from Grace's body. Despite the prosecution covering the contents with some paper wrapped around the bottle, the defense still objected strenuously, saying that showing the fetus would be too damaging to their client. And while D.A. Ward went full steam ahead with his theory that Chester beat her and threw her in the water to not have to take responsibility for their child, Chester's attorneys created a defense based upon cowardice. They argued that Grace had fallen into the water of her own accord, and that by cowardice rather than malice, Chester failed to save her. And all of this evidence that the prosecution had against him, his running away and his lies, these were only because he was afraid. As Brandon said, they were the actions of a frightened boy, not the actions of a murderer. The prosecution already told the courtroom all about how Chester was a great swimmer and had tons of experience boating, enough to know how to easily overturn a boat, and he was certainly capable of saving Grace should he have wanted to. The jury clearly was not buying what the defense was selling, and despite having only circumstantial evidence, the prosecution put forth an incredibly persuasive case. The prosecution responded to the defense's strategy by explaining that Chester had the motive, means, and opportunity to kill Grace, and had shown no hint of guilt or sadness or any sort of emotion about the girl he supposedly loved. And that if the defendant's case were true, and Grace's death was a suicide or an accident, it still didn't explain why he never told anyone or tried to ask for help. And then he went off to another resort where he had the time of his life. The DA argued, he left the body of the woman whom he says he loved better than anyone else and intended to marry, lying uncovered and unsought at the bottom of the lake. Ward closed his argument on behalf of the state with his 7-hour speech, saying, He is bloodthirsty and brutal. He is a blunderer. He does not reason on the lines that any one of us do. He reasons on different lines. Everything looks red before him. There is nothing but one object that he is going to grasp, and that is his personal safety. He sees nothing else. He cares for nothing else. He casts all these things behind him and says, I can do this slyly. I can get the girl on the bottom of the lake. I can do it secretly. I can do it carefully. I stand well in Cortland. I go to church. They think I am a paragon of virtue, a decent man, when in reality, I am a ravisher. I can take her out there and leave her body in the lake. After that, I can go and scratch my name on the rock up there in the woods, and I will go back to polite society all free and clear. Ultimately, as I understand it, Grace could have died in a myriad of ways, and it was just as possible that she drowned as she might have been beaten to death. And yet, it does seem like too much of a coincidence, doesn't it? That Chester has this massive problem on his hands, a responsibility he wants no part of, and when he finally goes to take care of it, Grace just mysteriously dies in a boating accident. They brought the boat into court to show everyone how difficult it would be to flip over in the water, so it would also have been a big coincidence that the conditions were perfect enough to have the boat flip, even though the waters were completely calm that day. And it's a coincidence that, despite Chester saying he took Grace there to get married, he kept the lease on his room back in Cortland, with his expensive possessions still inside, that on his way to the Adirondacks, he made plans with his female friends for the day after Grace died, as though he somehow anticipated Grace not being with him. That he just so happened to have packed his suitcase into the boat, and that the suitcase just so happened to make its way to shore, nice and dry, before the boat tipped over. That Chester, for no good reason, decided to bury his tennis racket as he fled Big Moose Lake. Chester had such little money that he skipped out on paying his hotel bills and asked for money to be sent to him. And yet, he never asked how much the boat rental would cost once he returned. These are just a few of the many coincidences that occurred if Chester truly did not murder Grace. Brandon doesn't buy the racket theory, but he also doesn't believe that Chester was wholly innocent either. He may not have bludgeoned her with a tennis racket, but there are plenty of other ways he could have caused her death, from pushing her into the water to psychologically abusing her to the point of suicide. Brandon argues that, quote, with all the evidence we have available, it seems difficult to come up with a scenario in which Chester was not somehow responsible for Grace's death, end quote. And as for the wounds on Grace's head, the defense argued that they could have occurred when transporting her body, though this doesn't explain why those who pulled her from the lake saw her bruised then. After the trial had ended, information came forward that it was actually a 13-year-old boy who found Grace's body. Apparently, all he saw was a giant white blob on the lake bed, so he took a long bowl and began prodding at it to see what it was. And this could also have caused the wounds on Grace's head. But this didn't matter anyway, because a verdict had already been rendered by that point. The trial, by the way, was a complete media circus, smack dab at the peak of yellow journalism when journalists cared more about outselling their competitors than in honest, ethical journalism. Brandon claimed that New York City journalists who were in Herkimer County for the trial began to make up stories so that they would have some justification for all of the time and money spent there. One of the press's inventions was the story of the other girl, the story that Chester had to get rid of Grace because he wanted to marry a wealthy woman back in Cortland. Even though he and Harriet Benedict had only spent several hours together, many newspapers printed reports that she and Chester were engaged to be married. And, according to Brandon, the papers wrote stories about how Chester had to kill Little Miss Poor to marry Miss Rich. Hundreds of people gathered at the Herkimer County Courthouse and Jail, desperate to get a glimpse of the famous Chester Gillette and hear the court proceedings. There were so many people, in fact, that people gathered even outside, hoping to overhear the trial. Reporters commented on how stone-faced Chester remained throughout, slumped back in his chair and looking bored. And when on the stand, journalists reported his many contradictions and overuse of the phrases, "I can't say" and "I don't know." And then there was his constant looking over at his attorneys for help, all the while the DA kept yelling at Chester, saying, "Don't look at them, look at me." In the end, the jury only took 5 hours to deliberate. They would have been ready earlier, since the first show of hands they took showed that each one of them felt that Chester was guilty. But they didn't want it to seem as though they had come to a decision too quickly, so they stalled for time. Some of the larger newspaper companies had a telegraph station set up in the basement of the courthouse, with wires leading to the courtroom so that journalists could send signals downstairs the moment the verdict was read, with the number of buzzes representing how he was found. For example, one buzz meant guilty of first-degree murder, two for the second degree, and so on. According to Brandon, there was no signal set up for not guilty. On December 5th, 1906, journalists sent down one buzz to the telegraph station downstairs. The jury convicted Chester Gillette of first-degree murder. Some reporters wrote that Chester looked pale and trembled when the verdict was read. Others said he dropped his head and staggered around, almost falling, and yet others said that Chester did not react at all, just as he had throughout the rest of the trial. But all agree that once the sentence was read, Chester scribbled down a message to be sent by telegraph to his dad, saying, "Dear Father, I am convicted." Chester's mother began campaigning on her son's behalf, trying to get his case appealed. But when the appeal, too, was denied, she tried collecting signatures to show the governor, hoping he would grant Chester a reprieve. At times, Chester's mom seemed sympathetic to Grace and her family, even reaching out to her mother. And yet, other times, she attacked Grace's character, accusing her of purposely becoming pregnant to hook Chester and force him into marrying her. Other times, she publicly blamed Grace for her own death, saying that, "This girl placed temptation in my boy's way." She also tried to help spread the word that Grace suffered from epileptic fits, and that she had one while on the boat, which caused her to hit her head and drown. Grace's doctor came forward pretty quickly to say that this simply was not true. On the night before Chester's execution, his mother and spiritual advisor visited him to give him comfort. It was also expected that Chester, knowing he was condemned, would save his soul by admitting his sins. Both the spiritual advisor and Chester's mother left him that night, satisfied that there was no legal mistake made, suggesting that Chester had finally confessed to them that he was, at least in some way, responsible for Grace's death. Chester's mom did later say that whatever else Chester was guilty of, she was glad to know that he never struck Grace, that whatever his other sins were, he never beat her to death with that racket. The next day, March 30th, 1908, a stoic Chester was led down the hallway and into the room he would die in. Chester took a seat in the electric chair, helped situate himself so that the equipment fit on all the right places, and listened calmly as the chaplain read Psalm 23 from the Bible. With a flip of the switch, 1,800 volts of electricity surged through his body for 1 minute and 3 seconds. Those who witnessed his death said it came easy, easier than they expected death to come. In 1924, Theodore Dreiser completed his novel, An American Tragedy. The book is about a young man named Clyde who was raised by poor religious missionaries, but later runs into a wealthy uncle who owned a shirt collar factory. Clyde begins working at this factory and eventually begins a relationship with a young farm girl named Roberta, with whom he ends up getting pregnant. And though Roberta pressures Clyde to marry her for the baby's sake, Clyde had already fallen in love with a wealthy socialite named Sandra, whom he planned to marry instead. When Roberta, portrayed as naive and slightly obnoxious, threatens to blackmail Clyde into doing the right thing, Clyde creates a plot to take Roberta out on a boat and murder her by pushing her off of the boat and allowing her to drown. Yet when it comes time to do the deed, Clyde becomes afraid and freezes. In a truly freak accident, Roberta accidentally falls overboard and the boat capsizes. Instead of saving Roberta, Clyde swims to shore. Though her death was an accident, Clyde incriminates himself with lies and contradictions. Ultimately, the court finds Clyde guilty and sentences him to death in the electric chair. An American Tragedy is based on Grace Brown's murder, though it doesn't completely adhere to the facts, the most obvious one being that there never was another woman for Chester the way that Sandra was for Clyde. But Dreiser's novel had a moral to it. He believed that Roberta, aka Grace Brown's death, was a distinctly American tragedy, in that he believed Americans were far too preoccupied with status and condemned them for their greed and ambition to social climb at all costs. An American Tragedy was adapted for the stage almost immediately. The novel, as well as the tragedy at Big Moose Lake, has been made into dozens of different books, movies, plays, and the like. In 1951, Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift starred in A Place in the Sun, which was based on An American Tragedy, and won 6 Oscars. Jennifer Connelly wrote A Northern Light in 2003, also based on Grace Brown's life and death, and the 2005 film Match Point, featuring Scarlett Johansson, also took inspiration from A Place in the Sun and the Brown-Gillette tragedy. Dreiser did not live to see all the adaptations made of his story, though he did see a 1931 film about it. Dreiser had a fit because he did not appreciate the way the film represented his novel. But, you know, that's okay, because I don't think Grace Brown would have much appreciated how his novel represented her life. I hope you all enjoyed episode 17 and that I didn't annoy anyone too badly with my sinus infection voice. I'll see you back here in 2 weeks for episode 18. In the meantime, check out our show notes for a list of our sources, as well as our website, oldbloodpodcast.com, and search for Old Blood Podcast on Instagram to view more information and images about this case and all of our others. Music credits to Shane Ivers at SilvermanSound.com.